For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
This afternoon, we're going to jump into something called the Jesus test. And sometime during this breakout session, I'm going to actually administer a test to you to help you determine how you're doing at following the Jesus of the Bible. Big thought for you here as we begin our time, that if you fail this test, you could do more harm than good with apologetics. The main theme for this year's Summer Institute. Now, I don't know about you, your journey into taking tests, but mine started pretty early. My mother drugged me into the doctors, and all of a sudden this man shows up with this big, long, white, you know, flowing outfit, and he has this crazy thing wrapped around his neck, and, you know, he's taking, pressing that into my chest and my back and all over the place, and before I know it, he's got this stick out, shoving it in my mouth, and I got a stick out my tongue, and Then he has this instrument, he's poking in my ears, and I'm like looking at my mom going like, "Mom, why are you doing this to me?" I would like to think that the test, that was kind of all downhill, but it just got worse, you know, as you get older. Some of you over 50 know exactly what I'm talking about. For you younger people, you haven't gone there yet. But, you know, at some point they're checking your blood, so somebody comes in and they stick your finger and you're like, what is up with our culture? I remember one day, the first time they took the rubber hammer and hammered my knee, I was right on schedule. Boom! I was like, man, next time give me that test again, doc, and I'll make sure I kick you for hammering me in the knee with that rubber hammer. I even had to take a test. I grew up on a farm. I had to take a test to demonstrate the state that I knew how to drive my 68 Rally Sport Camaro. I've been driving on the farm since I was 10 years of age, but they required that I take this test. And then of all insults, I look at my time graduating from high school, where I actually had to take this ACT test to determine if I was worthy of them taking my money from me so I could go to their institution. What is it with our culture and tests? Well, as I said, as you get older, the tests just get crazier. And some of you women are laughing because you're like, you guys have no idea what the tests are like. But all I can tell you is once I turned 50, I finally understood what it truly meant to get hosed. For those of you younger, you've got a surprise coming. It's about 28 feet long, I'll just tell you that. That's probably just too much information. Why is our culture so crazy about tests? Why are we so test crazy? Well, tests really are meant to reveal what is hidden, aren't they? They are meant to give us feedback and to see how we're doing compared to some agreed upon standard. Now, here's the irony in all that. As often as we give tests in our culture, I'm thinking that most of you have never, ever had a test given like we're going to take this afternoon. I mean, you can go to church for 40 years of your life, and you could never know how you're doing in terms of getting an A, a B, a C, or D, or whether you're flunking this thing called Christianity 101. Because the truth of the matter is, in most churches, I travel all over the world, in most churches, if you're showing up at the right time, and you're hanging out with the right kinds of people, everybody's figuring that you're doing pretty good on the test. But the reality is, just because we're in the right building, hanging out with the right kinds of people, does not necessarily mean that we are following the Jesus of the Bible. And if there is any one test you do not want to flunk, it's this Jesus test. We are told in 2 Corinthians chapter 13, 5 in the Message, to test ourselves to make sure that we are solid in the faith. Don't drift along taking everything for granted. Give yourselves regular checkups. I want to see if your church experiences anything like mine. I can't even begin to tell you how many sermons I've listened to in a lifetime and have forgotten. And have many times forgotten by lunchtime of the same day I heard the sermon, an hour and a half before. Anybody else kind of feel like you've been there and done that? You know, just getting the right information in and of itself doesn't mean that we are going to pass the test. And in this culture we live in, there are so many different ideas about who Jesus is. There's a website where you can actually go and you can tell other people your perception of who Jesus is. Maybe some of you have seen it. You just kind of, it says, Jesus is, and then you fill out the rest of the sentence. And look at some of the responses up here. Jesus is the worst thing to happen to mankind. Jesus is the genius within me. Jesus is wishing I would just trust him enough to let him heal me. Jesus is my personal shopper. You know, in our culture, people have all different kinds of ideas about who Jesus is. And even in the church, there's just people all over the map about who Jesus is and what he was all about. So maybe it would be good for us to say, well, if we're really serious about following Jesus of the Bible, how do we know if we're really following the Jesus of the Bible? Is there a way that we can examine ourselves and have some sense that the Jesus of the Bible, the one we read about in the Bible, is truly the Jesus that we are worshiping and that we are following? Well, this afternoon we're going to go there, and I think we're going to look at something that Jesus did over and over again with a certain group of people that kind of drive this whole point home, the difference between a true believer and make-believer, a difference between churchianity and real true spirituality. It starts in Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, and Jesus comes onto the scene. If you can imagine, he's just starting his ministry. You know, he's not well known. He's just kind of getting going. And he steps into a crowd and says, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, I don't think a lot of times when we read the Bible, we put ourselves into that context and start to get and let it influence our feelings. For instance, what if Jesus were here today and he said, "Hey, all you Xenos folks, unless your righteousness surpasses that of your head teaching pastor, Dennis McCallum, you have no hope of going to heaven." Some of you say, "Well, that's all right. I know Dennis. I'm okay. I'm in good shape." I don't know. But I'm thinking for a lot of you, if you go or maybe we say, "Hey, unless your righteousness surpasses that of Dr. Craig," who we've just listened to last night and this morning. I mean, put yourself in this setting and realize how this would have sit on people when they first heard it. Who were the Pharisees? Well, they were the people that not only were getting supposedly the A's in the test, they were the ones grading everybody else's test, weren't they? And Jesus was basically calling them out and saying, "Listen, you think these guys are the ones getting the A's on the test. I want to tell you something. These guys are flunking the test. And if you don't surpass them, you have no hope of heaven too." I think when Jesus said these words, there was a chiropractic moment. Or you know what I'm talking about? It's one of those double takes where you kind of go, "What did he just say? Did he just say what I think he just said?" I'm thinking he blew some people's minds here in Matthew 5:20. And there were all kinds of people whose heads were spinning after they heard what Jesus said here in Matthew 5:20. A couple of chapters later in Matthew chapter 9, let's pick up on the context here. It says, "While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees," here they are again, "saw this, they asked his disciples, 'Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?' On hearing this, Jesus said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." In the language of kind of this breakout session, you kind of hear Jesus saying, hey, the Pharisees are flunking the test. And he actually admonishes them to go and learn something, which is kind of interesting because these were the guys who supposedly were the experts when it came to religion. If you would, I think we could say it this way. Hey, you guys, you know, I mean, you think you've got your doctor's degree in religion? You guys need to go back to school. It's very possible that you could have been around the church for a whole long, long time and not be passing the Jesus test. In the same way that these gentlemen, who were considered doctors in this topic of religion, and Jesus is calling them out and said, hey, you guys need to go back to school. You don't get it yet. And he continues to drive this point home in several different other places in the scriptures. Let's pick up in Luke chapter 6. And he makes this comment. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High. Because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked, be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Here's this idea again of Jesus kind of setting the bar of what getting an A really looks like. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. The Pharisees, why were they flunking the Jesus test? Because first of all, they were called the Pharisees for a reason. That meant that the breakdown of the word Pharisee means to be the separated ones. They excluded everyone. In other words, if you didn't believe like they believed or behave like they behaved, they couldn't hang with you. They couldn't just do life with you because they did not want to get themselves dirty. This is why when Jesus ate with Matthew and his friends, they were so repulsed. Because from their point of view, if you were righteous, you actually separated yourselves and you excluded yourselves from people who did not believe and behave like you did. The second reason the Pharisees were flunking the Jesus test is they focused on gaining God's approval by following the law, which led to external displays of piety and checklist spirituality. The third reason they were flunking the Jesus test is they withdrew from the helpless, the sick, and the sinners. Almost everyone has heard the story of the Good Samaritan. You know, the story of the Good Samaritan was actually meant to drive home this point again. That in the story, there were two religious people who walked right on by the man who had been beaten, stripped, and left by the side of the road. But it was the Good Samaritan who was filled with mercy and compassion who actually stopped and allowed himself to get involved with this man who had been beaten alongside the road. It was the two religious experts, those who had the doctor degree in religion, who actually failed in that particular story. Why were they failing the Jesus test? Because they lacked love, compassion, and mercy. The Pharisees really missed a huge point that if we're not careful, we can miss in our spiritual journey. It's real easy to start confusing acceptance with endorsement. What do I mean by that? Well, let's check this out together.
I think something that's hard for Christians to offer people far from God is a kind of radical inclusiveness. Sometimes we feel like we have to be sort of lifestyle referees for people. And if someone drinks a little too much, if someone gets carried away at a party or misbehaves a little bit, something in us rises up and feels like we got to straighten them out. And that gets misunderstood quite a bit by people who are a little far from God. And in their minds, they're saying, this is just who I am. Why, if you're such a spiritual person, why can't you offer a kind of open-hearted acceptance to me? Why are you trying to fix me and change me and straighten me out? I like where I am, see? My deal is I will err on the side of radical acceptance as opposed to the refereeing thing. And I'll stand accountable before God someday. I don't know if I'm getting it all right, but I'm going to err on the side of grace giving, that's for sure.
I'm going to err on the side of grace giving. You know, I think of all the titles for Jesus, and there are quite a few. The one that I'm most enamored with and the one that touches my heart the deepest is this whole idea that Jesus was called a friend of sinners. I wish there was some way to, if we had an X-ray machine, to maybe get a read on what goes on in people's hearts when they sit in sessions like this. And it would have been especially interesting to kind of get a real picture of what was happening during the first breakout session when Dan and Scott, who I invited to be on stage here with me, were blown away by the fact that they were invited to do that. What was going on in people's hearts as this kind of thing was actually happening up here on stage? Jesus was okay with hanging out with the wrong kinds of people, with the wrong kinds of times and the wrong kinds of places. That's why he got the title of Friend of Sinners. And I do believe this title, he actually turned it back around on the Pharisees to show them that they were actually missing something. They were coming up with this title to actually put Jesus in one box to kind of demonstrate that he was inferior as a spiritual teacher. But he, on the other hand, took the title and turned it back around on them to show them that they were the ones who were actually flunking the test. The reason why I love this title is because in the depths of my heart, when I am so honest with myself, where I'm painfully honest about what goes on in my mind and my heart and the way I live my life, there are days that I can't believe that Jesus could love me. You have a day like that? Had a day like that? Maybe had periods of years like that? I get so blown away that Jesus could love a knucklehead like me. I'm endeared by that title. I feel like that title gives me hope on the days where I'm not getting it like I'd like to in terms of this whole thing of living the Christian life, that Jesus is a friend of sinners. The Jesus test, what is it? Well, I think we can make a case from the scriptures that we've been taking this test actually every day. We take it in our neighborhoods. We take it at the workplace where we work. The people we meet that cross our paths. I think you could actually say, based on what we understand from the scripture, that how we see and react to the people in our lives who do not behave like us and who do not believe like us could maybe be the truest indicator of whether or not we're following the Jesus of the Bible. You see, this is so flipped from the church because so often, depending on your church background, you're a good Christian if you're always hanging out with the right kinds of people at the right kinds of times and the right kinds of places. You're known, you know, and so a lot of times we can become church junkies. We're in every Bible study possible. We create a nice bubble world where all we end up doing is hanging out with people who behave and believe like us. And we don't have to face this test because we sequester or surround ourselves with people who are a lot like ourselves. I don't know about you. I'm going to give you a chance to talk about this. Those of you who were in the first breakout session. But I find a lot of times God actually uses people who are presently not yet Christians to stir up things in me that are not like Him. And I'm wondering if maybe some of you heard some things that kind of got you thinking, kind of got you wrestling during the first breakout session. I'm going to give you a time sometime here to talk about that. But the question I want to ask you this afternoon is, would those who know you well call you a friend of sinners? I'm thinking, now this would be a great title to go on your tombstone. Because, you know, if we were following the Jesus of the Bible, it would seem to me that this would be the title that we would all yearn to have put on our tombstone. That, hey, what would Jesus do? Well, He would hang out with sinners. He would hang out with people who didn't behave and believe like us, because that's what we know about Him. That's why he went to, you know, and hung out with Zacchaeus. That's why He went to hang out with Matthew and his tax collector friends. That's why He stepped into with the woman who was about ready to be stoned, and He spared her from this tragic end of her life, and instead, you know, offers her grace, but tells her on the way, now go leave your life of sin. You know, He didn't confuse acceptance with endorsement. He didn't endorse her lifestyle, but yet He offered a radical acceptance. And I really believe the reason why I'm giving this afternoon is because my belief is this, that if American Christianity, if there's going to be a comeback in our culture, because we are on a decline every year, less and less people are showing up to places like this, a church. And my belief is the only way we're going to recapture the culture is when we understand what it looks like in this day and age to be a friend of sinners. That maybe what we need to do is to embrace the idea that Jesus was all about playing more away games, where most of us in church always want to play home games. We want to invite people to our building, where our people are, you know, the majority, and we've got our experts up on stage. That's where we want to be. That's where we want to play. And the reality is, Jesus said He came to seek and to save that which is lost. And He was always going out and being in the people, with the people, in the world, but not of it. And I think if there's any hope for us in the future to not becoming more like Canada, and if you look at the spiritual reality in Canada, that's where we are headed. Canada is one step behind Europe. We're one step behind Canada. And if you don't know what that's like, just let me tell you, as one who speaks in these places, in Canada or places in Europe, maybe less than 5% of the people show up at a place called church on Sunday morning. You go to work and you say the name of Jesus in the workplace and people think you've got 55 heads. It's like, really? You're one of those? No. I mean, it's just like completely written off as irrelevant. And for those of you who are younger, unless something changes, your kids are going to have a hard time finding a believing spouse. Because Christianity no longer holds a dominant place in American culture like it once did. We're waning. But my belief is that when we show up in the culture with the same spirit of Jesus, who offered people radical acceptance but not endorsement, that now we create some God space where actually we can begin to have conversations. Conversations that God often uses to plant seeds and water seeds and cause ahas to happen in people's hearts and cause them to move maybe a step in their own spiritual journey, you see. So what is this Jesus test? Well, I'm going to throw up 10 questions here in a moment, and I'm inviting you to take the test right now. So if you pull out a pen and a piece of paper, what I'd like you to do is take these 10 questions, and I would like you to answer on a scale of 1 to 10 where you put yourself as you ask yourself each question. So put a number after each question and then add up all the numbers and come up with the final score, and we'll talk about your score in just a minute. Now, for those of you who can multitask, I'm going to play a song in the background, and I'd like you to be taking the test, but don't miss the lyrics to this song, because the author of this song, I think, so gets what we're talking about this afternoon.
Jesus, friend of sinners, we have strayed so far away. We cut down people in your name, but the sword was never ours to sway. Jesus, friend of sinners, the truth's become so hard to see. The world is on their way to you, but they're tripping over me. Always looking around but never looking up. I'm so double-minded. A blank-eyed saint with dirty hands and a heart divided. Oh, Jesus, friend of sinners, open our eyes to the world at the end of our pointing fingers. Let our hearts be led by mercy. Help us reach with open hearts and open doors. Oh, Jesus, friend of sinners, break our hearts for what breaks yours.
If you study the scriptures, I think at some point you come to the conclusion that to God, our hearts are always the heart of the matter. And I think Jesus was making this point to the Pharisees, that while they were observing the law, they had external displays of piety, but their hearts were missing something so much more. They were missing something that Jesus wanted them to fully understand. And it's something I think that, my goodness, I think we so need to understand, because if we do not, and we walk out of this conference armed with Dr. Craig's, you know, 8 silver bullets that we plucked from last night, and we go out of here with all of our arguments, and we show up out there on the streets, and we just get ready to blow people away, because there's a part of us, if we were really honest, that likes to be right, then I think we've missed the heart of the matter. That if all we're offering the culture is rightness, and we've missed kindness, I think maybe Jesus might say, go and learn what this means. Now, don't hear me in any way denigrate the idea that we need to be prepared to give an answer for the hope that is within us. I can just tell you, in my own journey, I mean, apologetics became a very heady thing for me early on in my Christian life. I trained under Josh McDowell. I was one of his interns. I mean, Josh McDowell at the time was considered probably the foremost apologist in the U.S. He had written Evidence That Demands a Verdict. People were reading his books all over the place. They still do. More Than a Carpenter. There's quite a few of them out there. And I loved spiritual cage fighting. You put me in the ring with an atheist, there is no way what happened here today on this stage, if you were in here, there's no way that would have happened. First of all, I wouldn't have listened to either one of them. I'd have been preparing my arguments, getting ready to blow them out of the water for some of the things they were saying. That's just kind of the way. And you throw me at the Mormons, the JWs, you put me in the ring with anybody who didn't believe what I thought was right, I was going to tear them a new one. But I never argued anybody in the kingdom. I'm not sure I even like the word arguments. And I know that word has been used by Dr. Craig. I'm not sure I like the word arguments because when I move into a conversation with arguments, then I'm moving into a conversation not so much to listen. I am entering into the conversation to win. And the moment you move into a conversation to win, where you feel like it's on you to win the day, there's a slippery slope there that begins to happen. And I can certainly say, as I look back, that I might have felt like I won a few arguments, but I might have lost the greater war. You know why? Because in a very real sense, I think maybe the greatest apologetic is how we actually do the conversation. If we are showing up in the conversation with kind of this smugness and this rightness, this moral swagger, like I'm right and you're wrong, it sets up an adversarial situation where the person on the other side isn't even able to hear us because a lot of times our stuff is getting in the way. It's blocking what Jesus intended to do because we aren't maybe sharing that rightness in the spirit of the kingdom. If you scored 85 or higher on this test, I want to suggest to you that you might be frequently misunderstood by other Christians. Think about that for just a moment. I remembered some of my early adventures in ministry where I was in the wrong places at the wrong times, the wrong kinds of people, attempting to live missionally. And you know what my greatest fear was? Not so much that the atheists were going to raise questions that I couldn't answer or that, you know, it wasn't that. I was afraid that Christians were going to see me. And because I was a faith missionary and I was supported by churches, that they were going to tell people who held the purse strings and my support was going to be pulled back. And I was starting to fear what other Christians might think of me when I'm actually out doing the work of Jesus. Does this make sense to anybody? That there's a real sense when you start living like Jesus and loving the people that Jesus loved, and reaching out to people that Jesus said he came to seek and to save, that you might get comments like, hey, you know, where have you been lately? I mean, like, we expect you to be here anytime the church doors are open. And I know you're doing the Sunday thing, but where were you Wednesday night? And where were you, you know, and so you start getting measured by whether or not you're showing up, when in reality, there's a real, very real sense that the Spirit of God could actually lead you away from the holy huddle because he actually has work for you to do that actually expresses the heart of Jesus. And biblically, if you want an example, look at Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. In the book of Acts, revival was breaking out, but the Spirit of God led Philip out And he separated himself from the holy huddle because he was being led of the Spirit, and he ends up coming across the Ethiopian eunuch who's reading the Old Testament, and he has questions, and Philip is God's man, filled with this compassion and this mercy, and he shows up on the scene and engages the Ethiopian eunuch, and many people believe it was the Ethiopian eunuch who ended up taking the gospel to Africa. Philip was willing to be at the wrong place, the wrong time, and hanging out with the wrong kinds of people. I would have preferred, man, revival breaking out. That sounds like a whole lot of fun. That sounds like a Jesus part of me. I want to be. But he was led by the Spirit to be somewhere else. If you were to ask most people on the street whether Christians are inclusive or exclusive, what do you think you'd hear? Interesting. I've done a lot of this kind of stuff. I do interviews a lot with people who are not yet Christians. And a couple things that really sadden me, sober me. One is that, you know, John 3:16 would be the most popular Bible verse known by Christians. But if you were to ask most not yet Christians, which Bible verse most popular? Hands down, judge not, lest ye be judged. Most popular verse by not yet Christians. I mean, let's just have a little cathartic moment here. What are some of the other labels if on the box Christian? What's the word on the street out there about us? One word: hypocrite, narrow-minded, judgmental, intolerant, conservative. Homophobe? Anti-intellectual? I'm so excited to be speaking to a bunch of anti-intellectual homophobes who are narrow-minded. What a privilege it is for me to be here this afternoon. You know, like it or not, I don't know that we're known out there as a friend of sinners. And that tells me that maybe too many of us are flunking the Jesus test. That we've just missed this piece, which is so, so very huge. Maybe after taking this test, you're ready to sing this song. Did you happen to pick up the vibe from Dan and Scott today? The vibe they took from how they were classified as depraved, and you know that question, and how that was one of the most off-putting things that they heard. It's real easy in our attempts to be right. And it's a heady thing. It is very intoxicating to be right. A Christian philosopher, well-known author, speaker himself, Dallas Willard, said it's very difficult to be right about something without hurting other people with it. And if you grew up in a family like I did, I grew up in a family where man, everybody was at the table fighting tooth and nail to get your point across. And you were always guarding your flank, and you always were like a good lawyer preparing your defense for everything that you said. So apologetics really then became this incredibly heady thing to go out and do that on other people. And it became a whole lot of fun when you feel like you finally had some ammunition in your hand to start blowing away the other side. And you can really walk away feeling pretty good about the fact that you just blew them away with your rightness. And yet I think the words of Jesus that we're looking at here have to echo and have to speak to us today, that that rightness without kindness, that we're missing the heart of Jesus. Did Jesus say some hard things to the Pharisees? Yes. In fact, if we continue to go on through the scriptures, he gets stronger and stronger with them every time until we get to Matthew, I think it's 25, and he calls them a brood of vipers, a bunch of whitewashed sepulchers. But understand in context that Jesus encouraged them to go back to school. Jesus wanted them to get this. Jesus continued to have conversation with them, but when they didn't get it, I think Jesus loved them so much that he actually threw a stick of dynamite their way, hoping that it might blow up their hardness, their stone-cold hearts, because he longed for them to get what we're talking about today. Now, here's a thought that really, truly might turn your head upside down. Have you ever stopped to consider that God might want to use our interactions with not-yet-Christians to save us from the Pharisee that lives in all of us? Have you come to a place in your journey where you're willing to admit that there's a little Pharisee that lives in you, that sometimes it's that habit that somebody has, or it's that lifestyle that somebody has who's not yet a Christian, and that just being around that just kind of pushes your button and causes you to kind of, you get repulsed? I'd like to say I've arrived. But it just seems like every time I think I do, I meet somebody that God uses to put that to the test. You been there, brother? You know? Let's just have an honest moment. What was stirred up in your heart today as it relates to what we're talking about here with the two guys on stage, Dan and Scott, for those of you who are here? If you would speak to that. Yeah, Pam. I don't know, do we have mics that we can, we still have the roving mics? Bring those up. We'll go get those so everybody can hear what's being said. See, I used to think when I was doing evangelism, I was the found person going out to reach out to the lost person. So they were, my idea was I was supposed to go out and give everybody directions about how to get found like I had been found. And of course, that puts me in a position of superiority where I end up, whether I knew it or not, just kind of blindly talking down to people. Did you pick up from the guys today that, boy, that's one of the things that really annoys them, just this idea of somebody showing up in the conversation, kind of talking down to someone instead of saying, hey, you know what? We're all created in the image of God. All created in the image of God. Okay, there are microphones coming here. Yep. Right up front here, Pam. We'll start here with Pam. And is anybody else? Go ahead and put your hand up. Here we go. We got two here right off the bat. Go ahead, Pam.
Well, you just hit on one of the... There were two things that especially struck me. One was... when Scott was sharing that you're in a conversation with a follower of Christ, and when they realize that you're really not interested, or he is not really interested in, you know, the whole thing about Jesus, you're not interested in the fact that he plays the piano and he loves martial arts, was his example, and they kind of get this glazed over look. And he said, I realize that it's a monologue, not a dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, they had in their head that they wanted to present, you know, what they believe, which he didn't even disdain that. It was just the idea, and what came to me was what a poor listener I can be. And I often have been that person who is sitting there thinking, instead of listening to them, okay, what's the next thing I'm going to say to convince them that Jesus is who he says he is?
Yeah.
And my intentions, I think, are good. I want people to know Christ.
Yeah.
But you know, the people, if people don't feel listened to, they certainly aren't going to listen to us.
Yeah.
And the other thing that really struck me was, again, Scott shared that he knows a person who actually mentors him, who's a walking a follower of Jesus. And when the question was put to him, what would convince you to follow Christ, he alluded to this person and said, essentially, when I see someone who has arrived. So I asked him, what does that look like? You know, someone who has arrived in their Christianity. And the way he answered said to me, essentially what you're saying in different words, it wasn't about winning the argument. It's about someone who is no longer egocentric, who has clearly forgiven, is empathetic towards other people. It was all about the character of Jesus and how Jesus yeah. treats people.
Yeah. Okay, over here.
You know, I was just thinking that how God gave us our minds to think, and we all have questions. I mean, there were a couple of comments from the people this morning, even in the crowd, about, you know, they doubted, and they weren't sure, and they've come to know Christ. But we all have that. I think whether you're just back in our lives, we all have had questions at one point or another. And then I'm thinking about the church. You know, the last 50 or 60 years, a lot of my family that have gone through divorce, the church has actually, rather than accept them and help them, we push them off to the side. We've kind of put that divide there. You know, for me, it's like at the end of the day, you got to ask yourself, do I draw people to Christ or do I repel people from Christ?
Mm.
And it's just a lot to think about. And I think, you know, some people were angry about the video and the Bill Maher thing, but I was talking a little bit about this after this morning's session with some friends, that this is what the world is seeing. And the one guy in the truckers' church that they had, who, you know, he just got up and he just, like, basically blew Bill off. And that's what the Christian community, or claimed Christian community, has done.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, over here. Bob?
Yeah, Doug. One thing in adding to what you said about a lot of people leaving the church is because the Christian church is the only church that teaches the concept of grace, and that's one big reason I believe. But the two questions I had for the gentleman this morning I didn't get to ask was in reference to the letter that you read to the gentleman that couldn't make it here.
Yeah.
He talked a lot on lack of evidence. There are some really, really good, substantiated books out there that are backed up with evidence on the Christian faith. I mean, really solid books. And some of these books are written by people that were atheists mm-hmm. that were set out to disprove Christ, like Strobel and them, that have turned around and completely have become strong Christians because of it. And the other question I had, so it just frustrates me when they put out lack of evidence. The other thing that was from the film clip that I wanted to bring out too was the question that was pointed to the gentleman that was asking all the questions. What if you're wrong? And most often, what I hear anyway, is the same answer that comes back in a question form: what if you're wrong? Well, my response back to the atheist, if I'm wrong, I'm in the same situation as you, and my life will end when this world ends. But think about if you're wrong and what we believe.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's one thing that I usually do ask them if, you know, after we've talked quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Not at the beginning.
Uh-huh. Anything else stirred up by this session this morning with Dan and Scott? Yeah, over here.
My first thought was, oh my gosh, are they brave? It took a lot of courage to sit up there. But I realized in the back of my head, I assumed they'd be very arrogant. And they were not. at all. But it was just a preconceived notion of mine, you know, that they would be arrogant and insist, you know, how right they are. And that's really wrong of me. I mean, I feel really bad. God definitely convicted me of that.
Thanks for sharing that. You know, one of the reasons why we did this morning, why I wanted to do this morning, why I asked the leadership here at the church to do it is I am convinced that what we need today is people who have convicted civility. That when we talk about people who we don't have any relationship with, we tend to demonize them. You know, oh, they're going to be arrogant. We do to them what people are doing to Christians. Christians are judgmental. Christians are just everything that you just said. And you know what? You can continue to live with those labels your whole life until you come face to face with another human being who kind of blows some of that up. And all of a sudden, something happens. And what that does is starts to knock down some walls. And sure enough, maybe sometime in the next couple of weeks, you're going to be in a conversation with somebody, and that conversation wouldn't have happened if you wouldn't have had that aha. Sometimes God actually wants to use people who are not yet Christians to save us from ourselves and some of the attitudes that we have. Thank you for being vulnerable enough to share it. Yeah, go ahead.
My thought is just a really simple thought that they were just men up there who wanted to be respected as people, wanted to be understood, just like me. And yeah, it was just really profound to have them up there being vulnerable and being just really human about who they were.
Scott didn't share this, but the first thing I said, Scott, what's, you know, my invitation? What's it stirring up in you? And he said, to be honest, I'm a businessman, and I'm afraid if I go here and do this, and I go public with my atheism, that the people in this church would never consider doing business with me. Now, isn't that a flip? Because sometimes that's what we as Christians, we stay silent because we're afraid that it might hurt us in terms of our popularity at the office, that's what happens when we have real conversation, isn't it? That something happens in us that couldn't happen if we just stayed kind of separate from people who are not like us. And this is why it's so important, I think. I really believe I meet Jesus a whole lot more in mission when I'm engaging people who are not like me, who don't behave like me, that the Spirit of Christ rests on me in such a more powerful way and is manifested in such a more powerful way in my own experience. So, maybe just a couple more. Anybody else? Over here? Yeah. Get a mic over here. Coming up the side.
Hi, Doug. I just want to make a comment on Dan, who proclaimed to be a Christian early on and saying that now he's not. What frustrated me was that he said he loved the Lord, and he kept repeating, trying to convince us, or convince me anyway, that he loved it. And I'm questioning him. It's almost as if there's something happened to his life, make me think about, was there something trauma, or I don't know, just kind of thinking about something happened to him to change that. I don't know what that was. He never explained it, or he just drew away from himself. I just feel like something happened. So he never explained, so it's just, would you mind if you could gather anything?
Well, I don't, you know, I told you, this was not staged here today. I just met these guys this morning. I talked to him on the phone in prep for this. There was nothing. So in terms of my knowing what that was, I don't know what that was. But if we were in conversation, you know, that would be a great question. We'll talk more about that in my next session about how do we, in our conversations, you know, move to another level. And that would be a great wondering question to ask him. Hey, I'm wondering if you had something that happened, back in 2007, a defining moment. That really kind of started this move away from the very thing that you spent so much of your life a part of.
Yeah, and I was wondering if he was very authentic about what he's saying, you know. I was kind of, he was not very honest with me when I was listening it. First, Scott was being more honest about his view. I don't know, that's the way I gather.
Yeah, I can't comment on that. As I mentioned, I think this title, Friend of Sinners, was actually a label of honor. And listen to...
I'm asked quite frequently,
Bill talks
is
about
my inclusiveness or acceptance the same as condoning certain behaviors that are not biblical? The person far from God usually has a hypersensitivity to feeling judged. And when it comes from a professing Christian, it's just like an iron door drops from the ceiling and they go, unsafe. I am not going to open up my heart to you because I don't need to be judged by you. And Jesus was called one time a friend of sinners, and he was called a glutton and a drunkard because he was hanging out with people who behaved that way, and apparently he didn't referee them to the liking of the Pharisees. I think he wore the badge of friend of sinners with a kind of honor. I think that's the spirit of Christ, and I try to figure out what would Jesus do in this setting.
Some of you might not be familiar with this book, but I'd like to read some excerpts from it. It's called My Trainwreck Conversion, and it's The Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert by Rosaria Butterfield. And the reason why I've chosen to read these excerpts from this book is if you grasp what she's saying here and you begin to export this in your own life, you're going to have stories like this. As I mentioned, the reason I'm doing this breakout session this afternoon is I am utterly convinced unless we reclaim this idea of what looks like a friend of sinners in this day and age, that we are well on our way to becoming like Canada spiritually. That the only way for the church, if you would, to grow is when there are people who are presently not yet Christians, that we are in conversation with them, that we learn how to hang out with them, we learn how to become friends of theirs so that they feel safe enough around us to actually have the kinds of conversations that might plant those seeds, water those seeds, and eventually cause them to say, I do to Jesus. Listen to Rosarita's Butterfield's story, and then I want you to kind of, as we walk through this story, if there's something that sticks out to you, it's like, wow, there was a big idea. There's something we need to grab a hold of, and let's talk about it. We'll come back around, and I'll open it up and see what you pick out of this. I'll start this way. As a leftist lesbian professor, she was actually a professor at Syracuse University. I despise Christians. The word Jesus stuck in my throat like an elephant tusk. No matter how hard I choked, I couldn't hack it out. Those who professed the name commanded my pity and wrath. As a university professor, I tired of students who seemed to believe that knowing Jesus meant knowing little else. Christians in particular were bad readers, always seizing opportunities to insert a Bible verse into a conversation with the same point as a punctuation mark to end it rather than deepen it. Stupid, pointless, menacing. That's what I thought of Christians and their God, Jesus. In 1997, I began researching the religious right and their politics of hatred against queers like me. I launched my first attack on the unholy trinity of Jesus, Republicans, politics, and patriarchy in the form of an article in the local newspaper about Promise Keepers. The article generated many responses, so many that I kept a Xerox box on each side of my desk, one for hate mail, one for fan mail. But one letter I received defied my filing system. It was from the pastor of the Syracuse Reformed Presbyterian Church. It was a kind, most men need to hear things twice, it was a kind inquiring letter. Ken Smith encouraged me to explore the kind of questions I admire. How did you arrive at your interpretation? How do you know you're right? Do you believe in God? Ken didn't argue with my article. Rather, he asked me to defend the presuppositions that undergirded it. I didn't know how to respond to it, so I threw it away. Later that night, I fished it out of the recycling bin and put it back on my desk, where it stared at me for a week, confronting me with the worldview divide that demanded demanded a response. Ken's letter punctured the integrity of my research project without him knowing it. With his letter, Ken initiated 2 years of bringing the church to me a heathen. Oh, I had seen my share of Bible verses on placards at gay pride marches. The Christians who mocked me on Gay Pride Day were happy that I and everyone I love were going to hell was clear as blue sky. That is not what Ken did. He did not mock. He engaged. So when his letter invited me to get together for dinner, I accepted. My motives at the time were straightforward. Surely this will be good for my research. Something else happened. Ken and his wife Flo and I became friends. They entered my world. They met my friends. We did book exchanges. We talked openly about sexuality and politics. They did not act as if such conversations were polluting them. They did not treat me like a blank slate. When we ate together, Ken prayed in a way I'd never heard before. His prayers were intimate, vulnerable. He repented of his sin in front of me. He thanked God for all things. Ken's God was holy and firm, yet full of mercy. And because Ken and Flo did not invite me to church, I knew it was safe to be friends. Isn't that an interesting comment? Then one ordinary day, I came to Jesus, open-handed and naked. Conversion was a train wreck. I did not want to lose everything that I loved, but the voice of God sang a sanguine love song in the rubble of my world. Ken was there. Flo was there. The church that had been praying for me for years was there. Jesus triumphed. Today, Rosaria Butterfield is a pastor's wife serving in North Carolina. And her book, The Secrets of an Unlikely Convert, is actually available in your bookstore because I requested it. And if you want to read about somebody who was on the other side and how they looked at this thing and then the whole process they went through, and it was a long process, you would find this book to be incredibly stimulating. What did you pick up on in her little story here that you feel like, boy, this could really be helpful to us as we seek to engage this culture we live in today? Yes, right here. We've got a mic coming.
She seemed to really want someone to be her friend, to be interested in her and her life, and to know her in a more deep way.
How did she define friendship?
Wanting to be with her, taking an interest in her, the things that she liked.
They met her friends.
They read her books that she offered.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And they talked about things, mm-hmm. Very openly and honest, mm-hmm. honestly, with her. And I think that to me, the most interesting line is she knew that they were friends because they didn't invite her to church. I think what I was hearing Scott say, if I was reading him right, is that the moment he says he's an atheist, right away people start to look at him either as a project or he's got a bullseye on his back. What she was saying is, hey, I knew they were my friends because they didn't invite me to church. Which is kind of intriguing, isn't it? Because so many times I think we think that that's the first place we got to invite somebody. And yet for a lot of people, the church is a scary place. And we need to understand that. Yes, over here.
I really like the point where he says that his prayers were intimate and vulnerable. He repented of his sin in front of me.
Yes.
And I think as Christians we tend to, like, we want to be vulnerable in front of people and we want to encourage them and be open with them, but we lack sharing what we struggle with. And I think we try and hide it because we want to come off as this perfect Christian image.
Yes.
But when we really draw near to people, we want to be vulnerable and say, like, God has grace on us because, like, this is what I'm struggling with. I have sin in so many different areas. And showing that God has given us grace even though we've gone through all these things and being able to relate to them with their sin.
I glory in my weaknesses so that Christ might be magnified. Here's a quote you can take to the bank. Perfect people keep real people away. And what was she attracted to? Not that the pastor stood up and gave great flowing sermons and he was a man of God, but that he was actually human and he displayed his vulnerability and he repented, that he was actually real with her. And could I stop here for just a moment? I really do believe in all the people I interact with out there, what they're screaming for from us is they want to meet real people who are sharing faith in a real way and answering real questions and doing that in a respectful way. I think that's what people are looking for out there. Yes, up here. Just about out of time here.
The thing that touched me was the last two words on the screen, Jesus triumphed.
Amen.
She talks about her train wreck life, but every one of us is a train wreck. And we need to have that humility. It's not about us winning or us triumphing.
Amen.
We need to stand out of the way and let Jesus do the triumphing.
It's not about, yes, yes, yes. Yep, that's so true. Well, hey, a parting thought on this matter, because we've got another session going to be lining up here. Let's land the plane here this afternoon.
Some people like to talk about how Jesus loved the unlovely, how he hung out with sinners.
And I take offense to that.
Because if you talk about the unlovely and how great it is that you love them, then you get to be all condescending and superior. You get to feel really good about this good deed that you're doing. I don't think that Jesus looked at people as good deeds. He didn't hang out with them to demonstrate his amazing tolerance either. Because honestly, nobody wants to be tolerated. We all just want to be heard and respected and loved. And Jesus did all of these things because he saw them as actual people. They weren't whore and bum and junkie and tax collector. They weren't seekers or sinners or even the lost. They weren't salvation projects or potential proselytes or golden opportunities for him to demonstrate his superior spirituality. They were just people with names and stories. And Jesus took the time to know those names and hear those stories. He wasn't too good to sit and eat with them and hang out with them. You could even say that these people, the misfits and the outcasts, they were Jesus' community.
Challenge you to think about the Jesus that we read about in the Bible. And men and women, I believe we can recapture this. The Rosaria Butterfield story. We'll have more stories like that to share. Because that story is a real story of how two people, and you got to know, I got to think that that pastor and his wife probably had some concerns and the people in their church when they were spending time with somebody like that, which meant they weren't spending as much time maybe with church folk, that maybe some folks might have misunderstood that. But that is the Jesus that I read about in the Bible, and I hope this afternoon you've been reacquainted with this Jesus, a friend of sinners. And if we could just start offering more of that to this culture, that there's some exciting things that lie ahead. Thanks for being here this afternoon. Appreciate your coming out. If you want to hang for questions, I'll be able to entertain some questions up front here while people are coming. Do we start at 3:30? Is that? Oh, okay. Well, then I can just, we can just do questions for a little bit. I thought we were. I had to be done and start again at 3:30. So go ahead, Pam. Question.
I just wondered who that was.
I know there were several people.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. She. Her name is LaDonna Whitmore, and she actually came onto the scene. Oh, maybe back in. In the early 2000s, they brought her into a Willow conference, and she explained postmodernism in a very, from a postmodern perspective. And she's got several things that she does out there that are pretty intriguing. Any other questions about the big idea this afternoon in this session? Over here.
Hello. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So I just wanted to know if you could touch on something for me. I hope I can get this out because I'm not good at speaking in front of people. So when I hear Jesus Friend of Sinners, I love that song, by the way. I cry every time I hear it. But it scares the crap out of me. Probably everybody in here has their own personal things that have nothing to do with their Christian walk, but that things that they hate, sin that they hate for other reasons in their life, and then it just kind of makes it bigger when you add the Christian aspect to it and gives you kind of a permission to hate it. And I know that's something you have to deal with, but I mean, is that something you can touch on? Like, you want to be out there, and let's say for a really extreme example, like a husband like needs to be, you know, is called to be out in sinners, like okay, with sinners, like not at bars and that type of thing, and the wife has an issue with that. I think that it can be a big division too, like when you're going out there for the, because Jesus was perfect, so he could go out with these sinners and be tempted and not do these things. But when we are friends of sinners, like we put ourselves in situations that can be really bad. So how you can do that and still be there, and I don't know, like how do you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're asking a question that really it is a tightrope walk, and there's a lot of holy tensions involved in that. First of all, I think we all have to monitor where we're at in our own walk with Christ. You know, if I'm sucking wind, it's not good for me to be putting myself in situations, especially if there were certain strongholds. You know, I can tell you way too many stories of men who attempted to win prostitutes to Christ and ended up in bed with the prostitute. Okay? And so, you know, sometimes what we have to do is be ruthlessly honest with ourselves that maybe we're putting ourselves out there because we actually enjoy going back to Egypt more than we actually are there because we really are being sent there and that God is wanting to reach out through us. So I think we have to be, there has to be some, and this is where a home group or some whatever, your faith community, you know, is part of that. And I think sometimes people use this as an excuse to kind of pet the kitty cat, so to speak. That area of their life that, you know, if it's the bar scene and they kind of want to go back to find out what they're missing out on, you know, oh, I'm going to go say that I'm going to go reach out. When in reality, I'm just kind of like, still kind of intrigued by that world that I walked out of. And this is where, you know, that honest walk with Christ comes in, and that having people around you who are in your life, and there's some accountability there. And notice that Jesus never sent his disciples out by themselves. He always sent them out two by two. So there's some built-in, I think, common sense there and all that. And I think... And then I don't think for most of us it's going to mean going to the craziest place on the face of the earth, like going to the Burning Man festival in the desert out there, or going to Sturgis or wherever it is that you can think is just like the wildest, craziest environment possible. Most of us have not yet Christians in our neighborhoods and places where we work, And we won't even show up. Sometimes Christians, you know, the happy hour on Friday afternoon or places where people are, you know, hang out, we just like, you know, that's a Christ-free zone. I'm not going to go there. And yet we don't understand that that if we want to increase the quantity and the quality of our spiritual conversations, we're going to have to find a way to get on their turf where they feel comfortable. Because what we are always trying to do is get them to come to our turf. And that strategy isn't working for us very well. So great question.
Doug?
Yeah, right here.
I love this topic. But as I was sitting here, I was thinking about just in my own life how it needs to be expanded to my home, my interactions with my Christian friends, that it's not just my not yet Christian friends that need, you know, just huge acceptance from me, but it is also my kids who haven't decided yet whether they're going to walk with God for the rest of their lives. So in my home, where it's easiest for me to be judgmental or arrogant, or, you know, it's to stop and realize that mercy there has power in my children's lives. And as we as believers in home groups are experiencing real acceptance with one another and mercy and forgiveness with one another, that creates the love that draws people to Christ as well.
Amen. Amen. And that's really, at the end of the day, that was God's intention, that our families would model this gospel, this kingdom-centered life, where we lived out of that message. And that probably nothing is a greater apologetic for Christianity than just what you described. A family that lives out of this, a marriage that lives out of this. You know, that speaks volumes. So, yes, over here.
Okay, so I have a couple coworkers, and I talk to them a lot, and we're like friends and stuff. But there are some times when they just all get into conversations about like the drugs that they're doing and stuff, and I don't know like how, like they know that I'm a Christian, and so like they kind of just like, okay, we're gonna talk about this, and even though she's sitting with us, like we're gonna kind of just talk around her because we know she doesn't really agree with it. So how can I like get into those conversations and like let them know that like I'm. Don't necessarily agree with it, but it doesn't really matter because I'm there to like talk to them about their lives.
This is the book I've been trying to write for the last year, but I've been so busy traveling, speaking. Is how do we practically? Those are the practical signs, kinds of situations. What do we do in those situations? How do we be in those but not be of them? And how do we? When we're around our friends and they're doing things that we don't endorse. And by the way, we don't need to tell them. They already know that we don't endorse those things most of the time. How do we create the kind of environment so that when they have that vulnerable moment, that we haven't done like the Pharisees and excluded ourselves from them, that at 2:00 in the morning, when they're tripping some night, and they realize that, man, life just sucks for me right now. Oh, yeah, my friend. She knows Jesus. I want to call her. So I don't have a short answer to that question because there are a lot of tensions in that. And there's not like an easy step one, step two. There's a context that you have to walk into and understand. But I just think it's so vital that we find ways to connect and continue to keep those lines of those phone wires, that wireless communication, that they know that whenever they want to dial up, that you're the person they're going to call and talk to. And the Bible says, hey, if you lack wisdom, call out to God. Let God give you the wisdom on how to pull that off. And that's the tension of mission right there. Anybody who's trying to live missionally is when you bump into people who are far from God and whose behaviors are definitely not anywhere near kingdom quality, like, how do we do that? I think One of the things I think we have to develop a holy sense of humor. Instead of being a pious old stick in the mud where every time we hear something we don't agree with, you know, our body language and all that stuff, we've got to learn how to be a fun person, and yet there's lines where you just can't cross, because you cross them, it's like you start becoming like them, and you start laughing at things that you know inside you really should be crying about. So I think you have to allow the Holy Spirit to be the umpire in your heart to lead and guide in those kind of situations. Over here and then over to Pam. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm kind of like the same way as that. It's like I just started coming back around to church and God and like doing my walk. But like my friends that aren't Christians and stuff, like I still want to reach out to them and everything like that. But they seem to want nothing to do with me because I don't have the same lifestyle that I used to. I was wondering, like, how do you talk with them still and like show them that like you're still interested in them and still want to hang out with them?
Yeah, I think it's what the guys were saying on stage up here. It's like, hey, you know, I mean, if doing drugs was the only thing you had in common, well, like, you're gonna have a hard time. Okay, if that was the lifestyle that you, and that's the only. I had friends like that, you know, that we were friends. We weren't really friends. We just did the same things. We go to the strip joints together. Okay, well, I'm not doing that anymore. So what does it start looking like? Well, so we like to flip the Frisbee around, so we're doing something like that. Or we're going to play sports or whatever it was. For me, that was more, sports was more my connection. But it's finding those other areas where we have common ground, because you know, there's just things that, you know, if you start going back to, you start opening yourself up back to those strongholds, and you'll find yourself back right back where you were real easy if you're not careful. You know, we have to beware in our attempts to win the world. Many times reverse evangelism can happen. And that's why you have to monitor what's going on in your own heart. So, yes, Pam.
I've been waiting to talk for a minute, but it's nice hearing everyone. I'd like to preface this by saying that most of you guys would probably consider me a not yet Christian, but what I consider myself is a seeker. And I think that this man's given you the best piece of advice that he could possibly give you, and that's to become a listener. Because I found that people have reached me not by telling me about God, not by telling me their story, but by listening to what I had to say, and by listening to what I have to say about it, which was not much. Usually I would say, well, I don't have much to say. I want to hear what you have to say. And I think that that's the biggest piece of advice, not just for religion, not just for Christianity, not just for your day-to-day life, but for your whole life, is that if you listen to people, they will teach you and you will teach them, and you can see it in their eyes when you talk to them. And so I just wanted to thank everyone for hearing what I had to say.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I agree with you.
I could almost pay for that, because I'm going to start off my next breakout. The whole focus of the beginning is just how important it is for us to listen and to listen. So thank you for your honest. That was nice. Yeah, Pam.
I just wanted to underscore what you said, Doug, about having a sense of humor and also kind of address a couple of questions ago. My husband and I and our family have found ourselves in a neighborhood that increasingly is primarily gay men. And we love our neighbors. They love us. We go to all of their parties. And frankly, we both sometimes feel very uncomfortable at their parties. And we also have a great time, but every now and then, there are some things that make us feel uncomfortable. And I do mean uncomfortable. It doesn't tempt me to sin or anything. It's just like, wow, I feel like a fish out of water right now. But they know we love them. And when you said humor, it just made me think of this, and I have to share it. Some people here know my husband. He's a very, very large man. And he was the last man, last straight man, I should say, left at the party. I had left, and the guys were talking about doing a, I don't know, a wig and bikini party or something. And they all look at my husband, who's getting increasingly more and more uncomfortable, and the host of the party, who ironically is Brad, my husband is Brad, said to my husband, "So Brad, are you going to be joining us?" At which point my husband said, "Only if I can wear my Speedo," which is not a good visual. But they loved it. And the point of my story is that after several years of, and we truly, you know, love all these people, one of them who has been very ill, I had the opportunity to take him to his doctor's appointments, and he has come to know the Lord. I have no doubt that he knows Christ. He, at this point in his life, is still living the gay lifestyle, but he asked me the other day if, when he passes away, if I would officiate his service. And it just was, is a great sense of privilege to know that I'll have the opportunity to share, you know, the Lord with a lot of people who may not yet know Christ.
Something about laughter. A lot of times laughter opens, someone said, you know, sometimes laughter opens people up, and literally while they're laughing, you know, you're able to slip the truth, because laughter becomes a WD-40 that prepares a heart for something normally that wouldn't be. So, yeah, I think there's something really important about us developing a holy sense of humor where we're in uncomfortable moments, we relieve the tension with that laughter, because they're aware, they know. And you know, I've got numerous wild men in my life. One guy, he's always trying to push my buttons. You know, and he's always trying, that's how his, he's trying to get the upper hand. And I deflect that with, you know, just making some comments, just to start laughing and say, "Hey, I know, man, come on, Brian, I know where you're going with that." And he'll start laughing because I'm kind of in a nice, polite way saying, you know where you're going and I know where you're going. And so, let's just be honest about that. And hopefully this Sunday he's going to be in church where I'm preaching. He never goes to church. I'm preaching somewhere. And I said, "Hey, I got some free entertainment for you this weekend." And the reason I invited him, I normally would never invite him to church, but his church is like a stone's throw from his house. And so I said, "Hey, it's at 11 o'clock. You can sleep in and still get there in time." And so I'm starting to kid him now the way he likes to go after me. So we'll see this Sunday if he ends up showing up. Maybe one more, if you got one more. If not, we'll. It's about that time.
I was just thinking about all these points being made, and I think where it all really starts is actually to draw near to the Lord. And I was thinking about in your book where you made the point of, I can't remember what chapter it is, but you said maybe we should start off our day just saying, like, "Lord, like, help us to see people as you do," you know, and. And I think that's a great point. It's like, are we doing this for our own self-benefit, or are we doing this because we genuinely know where God has saved us from, and we want others to know this too? Yeah. And from that, like, I was also thinking about Philippians 2:4. It says, "Take an interest in others, you know, before ourselves." And I think that's so huge too. Not just an interest from our own self-motivation or whatever, but genuine interest because the Lord views the interest.
Yeah, I think there's something huge to that. The whole idea that now often Christians will say to me, and I get this in a lot of audiences, "Doug, we just don't have anything in common with not yet Christians." I'm going, "Really? I'm seriously? I mean, did you go to college? Are you a son? Are you a daughter? Do you have a job? Do you have kids?" I mean, I start going through all the life experiences. It's like we have all these things in common. It's called the journey of life. And I think in terms of finding common ground in those conversations, if we want to engage somebody, the secret of being interesting is to be interested. And so as we start showing interest in things that they are passionate about, that they're concerned about, that they get, you know, it's what turns them on in life. You can start talking about those things and like, wow, in 5 minutes, you know, strangers are just friends waiting to be met. Because people out there are starved for someone who will listen to them and show an interest in the things that matter to them. It's not rocket science. And when we start to do that, we start to become known as a friend of people who don't necessarily believe and behave like us. So, well, hey, thanks for being here this afternoon. And if you'd like, I hope you'd choose to stick around, because in the next session, we are going to talk about apologetics for ordinary people. Natural, doable, and authentic apologetics for people who aren't giant brains and are very cerebral. And maybe some of you have felt like you can't swim in the tides that have been flowing here and some of the talks. Well, we're going to put the cookies on the bottom shelf in the next session, all right?
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.